Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I am your host, Doug Stewart, and I have my co-host on with me, Cody Cook. He's also kind of the guest. We're just going to talk about film and movies, or whether or not we should use the word film or movies. That's the whole debate today. We're just going to discuss whether or not we should say film or movie. No, I'm kidding. Cody, thank you for joining me for this episode, because you and I get to talk about movies a lot. And I mean, most of the movies that you like to watch are older than Lincoln. So I need to watch all the movies that I never got around to watching. But you're really good at analyzing themes and concepts in film. And I like to try to learn to do that myself as much as I as much as I am often into movies for either somewhat entertainment value or, you know, particular director or something like that. So anyway, you're one of my favorite guys to talk to about film. So here we are. And one thing that I want to make this thematically appropriate and relevant to our audience, the Libertarian Christian audience, is do you use film or movies? And you can differentiate how you think of those words if you do. Do you use film to converse with people a lot? And in particular about libertarian themes or even Christian themes?
Well, and whether you use film or movies or cinema, it really just depends on how pretentious you're trying to be.
So that's really all this is. It's about being pretentious. Do you spell theater with R-E just to?
Sometimes. If it's a place, then I spell it E-R. But if I'm saying the theater, then I do it R-E. But okay, yeah.
So you say it R-E, but you. No, I'm kidding.
Theater. And just to kind of piggyback what you said earlier, we've talked about movies. We've traded some of our kind of top 10 lists, and you watched a few of mine. I've watched a few of yours. I got to get through. So there's a couple of years that I'd seen before, but it had been a while. I think one that you'd recommended was Ocean's 11. And I was like, man,
I don't know why anybody would love this, but I like Doug, so I'll watch them again.
Well, no, it's funny. I remember seeing it when it came out, and I forgot. It's so fascinating to watch because it's like so of the era.
You say Ocean's 11?
Ocean's 11, yeah, because it's like a music video. And
it really is, yeah.
Yeah, and so, like, I think when it first came out, I was like, yeah, but, like, watching it now, it's almost a little bit like a time, you know, a timepiece in a way. You're like, oh, this is kind of fascinating. This was, like, this was what we thought, like, movies should look like then. That was kind of that big sort of slick, you know, kind of quick cuts and, you know, kind of Jerry Bruckheimer. And I'm not dissing it. It's just really interesting how that was just really that kind of MTV moment.
How it hit you different. Actually, you know what? I should probably ask you first, now that we're just kind of getting to know each other about this and doing this for the sake of our audience. Where did you start getting into film and understand? I mean, I know you said you made something when you were a teenager and that kind of thing, but, like, did it predate that, or were you just like, you saw an 8mm camera and you're like, I got to do this?
Yeah, no, actually, I started trying to make movies when I was like a kid. I had the idea for like a horror movie. It was a monster that turned into water. And so, anywhere where there was water, that might be the monster. Right. And so that was one of my early attempts. I also tried to do a parody of James Bond. I would have been, I don't know, like 12 or something, maybe a little younger. I'm around about 12. And I hadn't actually really seen almost any of the Bond films, but I played a lot of Goldeneye. And so I sort of got the joke a little bit, kind of the how it was done. And I'd seen Austin Powers, so that was kind of it. But I think what got me into movies was probably my dad. He liked a lot of like 70s and 80s comedies, and so like I developed a real kind of strong appreciation for like Chevy Chase. And he showed me, I think, the Marx Brothers first. I saw them with him before, you know, that was kind of my first introduction to them. And I think a lot of like my humor is very much in that kind of Chevy Chase, Groucho Marx, Cary Grant, that sort of sarcastic, sort of a self-important jerk a little bit. So I've had to come to that. But this was one of my early humor influences. And so, yeah.
I think that stuck. I think some of those stuck.
A little bit. Yeah, I've had to work on it some. I also watched like a lot of Nick at Night, which for those who are a little bit younger, Nick at Night used to play old TV shows, right? And it wasn't just sort of like, you know, back-to-back Friends and Mike and Molly. And so, you know, you'd watch, like there'd be shows from like the 50s, 60s, 70s. I think that at that time, the most recent show they had was Taxi, which was like the early 80s. And so that was kind of recent. That's sort of like between now and Friends or something. But there were all these sort of old shows, and I was kind of interested in the stars and the guest stars. People showed up, and it kind of got me curious and wanted to learn more about them. I don't have it with me, but I actually was able to repurchase a book that I had. I had a guide to Nick at Night episodes. It was an episode guide for all the shows that they were playing. And I just poured through it, and I learned about all the episodes and a little trivia. And that was me as a kid. So I reached my like preteen years, and I become sort of a hipster. And so I start adding like art films and kind of cinema underground to my interests. And those kind of weird like 1960s kind of outsiders who are making films you know, Kenneth Anger and John Waters. John Waters might be sort of more familiar, but so I think I was really just kind of interested in that kind of alternative world that was kind of being birthed in the 60s. And so anyway, so there was kind of all these different things coming together. They're really kind of old, kind of 1950s, you know, approach to film, and then that sort of edgy stuff. And so you kind of put it all together, and it's a fairly broad number of influences coming together.
Okay.
So yeah, I watch movies that came out when I was younger, but I was always really interested in a lot of the older stuff.
Why do you think that was? It's just your dad's influence, or just, you know, personality?
I'm sure it's part of it. I mean, the fact that my dad was watching a lot of comedies, I think, was part of it, because, you know, you'd sort of sit with your dad, and there were things you were laughing at, right? And so that sort of informs your sense of humor.
Yeah.
And, you know, so stuff in the 90s was a little different. The comedy was a little bit different. And so, and I still, you know, I would still sneak and watch Beavis and Butthead, and I'd watch Biodome and stuff. Those kind of really bad 90s Pauly Shore movies and stuff. But I think it gave me sort of a sense of, I think, how humor in particular is not just one thing, but there can be a lot of different approaches to humor. It can be very sophisticated, you know, very, very kind of smart, very sarcastic, or just very kind of dumb. And so I don't know why, I got so interested. I think Nick at Night was part of it. I just got really zoned in on that kind of stuff. And I've, you know, and it's obviously like, shaped my theological approach too, right? Where it's like, okay, well, this is really, and just this new theology is really interesting, but like, what did Athanasius have to say about this? I think, you know, the sort of idea that Neil Postman has this quote that always stuck with me, that he's about reading, where he says, reading frees you from the tyranny of the present. And it's this idea that you're sort of, when you're in a time and a place, you see everything through that cultural lens without realizing it. And so when you can look at things through a different lens, you realize that the world is bigger and more complex and more interesting. So maybe that's it. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything like in your childhood, any movies that maybe you went to see or saw it from home that like stuck with you and impacted you? I mean, everybody that knows me knows what mine is, but which I can share, but I'm just kind of curious, like, do you have any for me, for you? I mean,
so there were two that were very formative for me, that were actually not very well liked when they first came out, but have since become, you know, kind of cult films. One was called Monster Squad.
I feel like
you ever seen Monster Squad?
Remind me what it is about. I might have.
So it's basically the Goonies, but with the Universal Monsters. You know what the Goonies is when I say the Goonies?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
Universal Monsters.
You know, so the Universal Monsters, like Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman.
Oh, got it. Okay. Yeah.
Those kind of Universal Studios.
No, I haven't seen this movie.
So that one I watched all the time. And I think, the other one I watched was called Cabin Boy. Did you ever see Cabin Boy?
Sounds so indie film.
So it had Chris Elliott, who was kind of big at that time. He did a show called Get a Life. And Tim Burton had done the Pee-wee stuff and was looking for like the next Pee-wee, some kind of a quirky guy. And the thing about Chris Elliott, he's very funny, but he's also not very likable. Like, he plays a lot of characters that are just kind of unpleasant and get under your skin. Yeah. And so, but Tim Burton was like, this guy's going to be the next Pee-wee Herman. I'm doing this movie with him. And they're doing like, these kind of almost like a parody in a way of like these sort of old adventure movies, but there's like, you know, monsters and sea creatures and stuff like that. Anyway, so all the funding comes in based on Tim Burton doing it. And then I think he got the chance to make Ed Wood. And he's like, well, this is like a dream of mine. I've got to make Ed Wood. So he stayed on as a producer, but a lot of the money dried up and he just wasn't overseeing it anymore. And it was like released and was hated. Like people just, it was constantly mocked. And it like ruined Chris Elliott and his co-writer Adam Resnick's careers. And there's actually a great, a recent DVD was released, like a special edition that had like a commentary and behind the scenes and stuff. And the subtitle on it was, I think it was the film that angered a nation. And so they really kind of leaned into this, like this movie just made everybody angry. I love it. I thought it was great.
Okay. All right.
Anyway,
do you feel like, I feel like I'm just quizzing you. just like running down our questions.
You're trying to sort of get to the heart of what happened to me and what's wrong.
Yeah. Well, maybe there is a little bit of that going on. I don't know. I mean, it is interesting to get to know you this way. Cause I didn't ask you these questions. I mean, I didn't send you these questions ahead of time. I mean, you saw the list in one sense, but we haven't had a conversation about this. And it's funny. This is typically the kind of thing we'd probably have a conversation about over the phone or just like, yeah, as we're chatting and so forth. And here we are letting people in on things. So, all right. You mentioned comedy and you said that there's different types of comedy, some that are more sophisticated, mm-hmm. others that are just kind of dumb and silly. And, you know, then there's sarcasm and there's like slapstick type stuff or like body humor, people getting, you know, knocked over, that kind of like Three Stooges type stuff. Mm-hmm. Are there other genres that like appeal to you just as much, or do you feel like and are there any that are kind of like you just don't go there? Like for me, those are horror films. I've seen a couple. They were fine, but I typically don't go to horror films for any sort of entertainment or even, you know, film buffery.
Right. Well, actually, real quick, before you say that, I had another realization as you were talking, which is another reason why I think I started digging into all this old stuff is because I wanted to get the reference. And so you'd watch something, like you'd be a kid and you'd be watching Saturday Night Live or something, and there'd be a reference to something that's older, that's not familiar. And so I think that was a lot of that was just, or Nick at Night, they'd reference some movie star or something. And so for me, it was a lot of that. Like, I got to get this reference. So I'm collecting all these references so I can put together like kind of a picture of what the world was, pop culture at the time. That's part of it. Okay. So now,
genre. Why was that important to you?
I don't know.
I mean, it would be important to me because I don't like to feel out of the know. Although I will say that as much as I haven't really paid attention to Star Wars stuff, I get most people's jokes when they talk about Star Wars. And even sometimes Star Trek, I guess it depends.
I think for me, it's when I get sort of interested in something, I get really focused on it in a way. I mean, that was kind of the reason I went to Bible college was because I go, oh, I'm a Christian, so I want to get this. Like And there's lots of ways you can do that. You can just go to church a lot or pray a lot or whatever. I was like, I've got to understand like the academic approach to this. I want to understand the history. I want to understand hermeneutics. Yeah. I want to understand, you know, so anyway, there's a lot. I think that's part of it. But
yeah. Okay. Genres then.
So genres. I mean, I'm pretty open. I don't know. There's not really genres I stay away from other than, you know, like pornography. But I think, you know, my wife was like resistant to musicals and Westerns when we first met. Those kind of very masculine and very sort of feminine genres. And, you know, I think I told her at the time, like, there's great movies in just about every genre if you look for them. Right. Hmm. And so, like, I'm not necessarily like an anime guy, but there's some great films that were made, animated films that were made, come from Japan. Right. And so, like, for my wife, I got her into Westerns through Clint Eastwood. I had to know a little bit about like, okay, well, John Wayne is a little too old fashioned for her. She's not going to like it. But Clint Eastwood, especially the violent, the vengeful movies like High Plains Drifter, she loved. She's got a lot of kind of anger in her. And so she really appreciated that. Whereas like a movie, like a later Clint Eastwood, a movie like Unforgiven that deconstructs the kind of the narrative about the kind of the gunslinger and how great it is to get revenge. That's such an interesting movie because it's all about how mundane and unpleasant the violence could be. And that just didn't hit her in some way. It's a fantastic movie. I love it. She doesn't like it. She wants to see the High Plains Drifter where he's got the whip and he's getting the revenge. She loves that. And, for me, there's like some genres that I'll probably look at less. Like I'm not necessarily a big musical guy, but like West Side Story is a great movie. Seven Brides for Seven Brothers is a great movie.
Okay.
And so it's just, you know, it is what it is. You appreciate what it's doing in that genre, and you just kind of have to accept, okay, they're going to start singing now, and I just can't let that bother me.
So musicals are not your thing?
Not generally, but with some exceptions, but not generally.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess if you approve of West Side Story, I need to go watch it because I haven't seen it. So
it's good. It's long, but it's good. It's good. And it, there's a great actor in it. Oh gosh, I forgot his name. He's also in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. He was in the show Twin Peaks as well. He played the psychologist. But he just did this incredible just dance work and stuff. There was a movie he did where there was a dance called the Shovel Dance. Was that the Fastest Guns in the West? Maybe Fastest Gun in the West. Is that what it's called? I think so. And he just does this like incredible, just like thing, this dance with two shovels, and he's like just jumping all over the place. Anyway, sorry. You can't when you see something that's good or you see someone that's talented, you're like, you can't deny it. You might not like the genre, but it's good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. I want to talk specifically, we kind of pivot to kind of the core of the conversation here is approaching movies and film beyond mere entertainment. And I'm going to say that because when I grew up, my family's approach to film was almost purely for entertainment. And there were some times where films would have a message. And I'm sure my parents, I mean, they didn't talk to me about this at the time, but I'm sure they talked to each other about like, oh, well, let's go see that. It has a heartfelt message where, you know, our kids will feel, you know, uplifted or whatever, or it's just funny. You know, I think of things like, Beethoven about the dog. I think it was a John Hughes film and some others that were like, oh, okay, well, like these are just fun, lighthearted. They're like, you know, relatively safe in terms of content for kids because they're only PG and it wasn't the 70s. And the... the idea that we would sit down and watch a movie to analyze it, to see what it might have to teach us, to see, you know, how is this played as art, other than maybe to, maybe the acting would do that to some extent and be like, oh, wow, that person's a great actor. We love Tom Hanks or we love, you know, Macaulay Culkin or something. I'm just joking there, but like something like that, where it's just like, oh, wow, that person's a really good actor. I'm going to go see their stuff again because I really like what they have to say. That was like the level of artistic value that we would place on films. And yet we would not actually watch a lot of films. I grew up relatively sheltered and it was kind of weird because I would be not allowed to listen to like Christian rock music, but like my dad would take me to see Schindler's List, Jurassic Park, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. They would let me see these things that were entertainment. And as long as there wasn't sex in them, or tons of language, again, we accept for Saving Private Ryan because it's a war movie and, you know, that's just how it is. So there's all these weird exceptions and so forth. For the most part, there was a lot of entertainment value. Now that I mentioned Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List, those were probably kind of the exception where it's like, oh, well, these are teaching some sort of historical, you know, situation that, you know, we want our kids to know about. You know, my mom's dad, who I never knew because he died before I was born, was in World War II and he was in the Battle of Normandy. And so, of course, my parents are going to be like, oh, wow, you know, that, you know, let's go see this. This is great. But outside of that, this is almost entirely about entertainment. So that's a long lead up to talking to you about how can we look at movies beyond mere entertainment and kind of enjoy them for their artistic value as well. And then we're going to actually talk about a couple of films. You're going to have a couple. I have a couple that I want to share, and I picked mine with a very specific theme, and I'll just kind of open that up when we get to it. But how do we approach movies beyond entertainment?
Yeah, well, and you mentioned a word also, message. And I think that's almost a third category in a way, because I think, you know, sometimes you can go so heavy handed with a message, be so ham fisted that it doesn't really have a lot of artistic value. Right. And so you think of a lot of the films that are made, the kind of, you know, the movies for Christians are often very much like that.
Yeah.
Or the Atlas Shrugged films that were made.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you're sort of preaching to the choir, that's a different thing than, you know, so for example, a movie like Full Metal Jacket, Kubrick film. So okay. Movie about Vietnam War. Oh, it's a good movie. But the first part of it is really good, and then it falls off. And it's because the first part of it is about this relationship between these guys and their drill instructor and how everything goes awry. And then the rest of the movie, like, it sets the tone a little bit, but the rest of the movie is, I think, a little too heavy-handed with trying to be messagey.
Yeah.
And so it loses you a little bit.
But do you feel like Born on the 4th of July did that?
You know what? I've never seen Born on the 4th of July.
Okay. We just watched it. My wife and I just watched it this summer, maybe, I think. Well, that doesn't help if listeners are listening later. So 4 or 5 months ago, that doesn't really matter anyway. But we watched it and we felt like it wasn't preachy, even though it was clearly an anti-Vietnam War movie. But anyway, but you can keep going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, or and I mean, another Vietnam War movie the one that was based on Joseph Conrad's book Heart of Darkness, but they made it about Vietnam instead. Apocalypse Now, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. That's really interesting because, like, the setting is Vietnam, but it's really this, it's all basically based on that book, Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. And so that's partly what makes it really interesting. And it's really well made. Like, there's a message there, but it's kind of more broad. It's not really about Vietnam exactly, you know?
Yeah. So you're saying some films will go too far and, like, overdo the messaging. It's heavy handed. That's a good way of putting it. I always think of it as preachy, but that's probably not quite the right word all the time.
And I was a teenager and I started making movies, my movies that I tried to make were always heavy-handed message films. And part of it too was like the filmmakers that I thought were really interesting, guys like John Waters, everything was over the top. So if there was a message or if there was acting, everything about it was over the top. And so that was kind of what I emulated. I liked that. I thought that was fun, that kind of kitschiness.
But you've repented since.
Mostly. Sometimes I like it, but mostly. I remember reading somewhere, like, the difference between art and craft is that art clarifies value. So craft is, you may be a good director, you may know how to, you know, put together a film, but are you saying anything? Are you clarifying our values in some way? Are you getting people to think about what's important, you know, in the world or in their lives, right? So stories can help us to think about the world in different ways than we might normally. And some do it better than others. Sometimes, especially movies for kids, they'll have a heavy-handed kind of message that's kind of thrown in there about friendship or family or working.
Yeah, together. Right. Loyalty, sacrifice, you know.
Yeah, but you know, a movie that stands out to me that is not considered a Nazi film, but I think clarifies values in a really important way, is Napoleon Dynamite. Have you seen Napoleon Dynamite?
I haven't.
Man, I thought everybody's seen Napoleon Dynamite.
I know. It's sorry.
That's right.
Because that'll be on my next.
It's stupid and funny, but really it's about these, like, friendship, I think, in a way that's endearing, but not, like, you know, syrupy sweet, right? And so I think it hits you in a way that it feels real. And I think that's part of it too. That's why the message movies often don't work. Is it's not really about the human experience. It's about some writer director's
agenda.
Point of view.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And so to me, that's when a movie has that, like when a movie can unearth something hidden or something or surprising truth or say something true, but from a different angle. One of my favorite movies, we were talking about genres. I'm not necessarily a big rom-com guy, but there's movies that are kind of romantic comedy sort of genre. And one of them is called A New Leaf. And it had Walter Matthau. Elaine May was in it. She also directed it. I think I might have recommended it.
Yep. I don't know if you watched it. I remember now. Yep.
Yep. And
that was the first one of your suggestions that I believe. He's like a goofy, aloof kind of guy. Or no, she's the goofy and aloof, and he's like always pulling her in. Is that the one?
Yeah. So basically. he's a rich guy who's inherited all this money, and his money's running out. And so he has to marry somebody, but he doesn't like anybody. And so his plan is, I'm going to marry this woman and then I'm going to inherit her fortune. I'm going to murder her, which is a great premise for a rom-com. And so, and I won't ruin it, but there's going to be some spoilers, I have to say, in some of these conversations, but when he realizes that he really does love her, like, it's such a fanciful, you know, kind of out there kind of scenario.
It's quite funny too. And I'm not one to go back to, you know, pre my birth and watch movies.
Yeah. Oh, so funny. But like when he sort of has this realization, like what it is that makes him realize he loves her is very down to earth. And it says something, I think, about I think human love in a way that's really kind of surprising, that it's, you know, the ways in which we kind of connect with people and realize that we care about people, and that, you know, basically it's, I think, to kind of sum it up, first he sort of despises her because she needs him all the time because she's just doesn't know how to do anything. And, but in the process of like, he actually discovers as he's doing all these things for her that he actually has talents and he has abilities, and he finds meaning and fulfillment in that. And he also just like, he learns to love her through that process. And it's something about the way that love can be generous and giving, and that you're not, you get something from it, but not in a transactional way. You get something through your giving. And that sounds so sappy, but the way it's done in the movie is just perfect.
Yeah, it's not a sappy film. In fact, it's a lot more, it's like, there's like this awkward, clumsy humor to it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what makes it kind of funny. And you're just in a little bit of like, oh my goodness, really? Yeah, it's not sappy at all, I don't think. And those movies back then were not as sappy as what we see in like the 90s and later, where they just kind of dwell on the romance part. So
they do. Well, and it was made in the 70s, and there was the opposite problem you had in the 70s, because everything was going to be edgy, and it was all about, you know, young men in their 20s who are coming to terms with the fact that the world sucks and they don't have a place in it, and they're kind of lamenting the whole. And they tend to be kind of dark, and they're kind of character studies, but they don't really go anywhere. And so that's oftentimes what happens in the 70s movies. Like, I think a movie like Taxi Driver, which I think is a good example of that genre, but I think is kind of is one of those where it's about the guy who's disaffected and doesn't fit in the world. And anyway.
Yeah. How do we get on? We got on to, the messaging and how to think of films beyond entertainment.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should answer that question. Well, yeah, I think it's just, it's about that thing. Is the movie clarifying your values in some way? Is it testing your values in some way? Is it giving you a different way to think about what's important to you? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to love or hate, or to, I can kind of live in the world. I mean, is there meaning to life? Is there meaning to morality? Or is that something we make up?
Hey everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's a really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
Yeah, I think those are interesting questions, because I went to a Bible college, and they had a drama program. And they had this sort of like semi, wasn't quite ready yet program where there was like film studies. And so that was the track that I took. And I remember my roommate, I remember saying that I was kind of leaning into this a little bit, which is why I'd seen some of the old, like I saw Battleship Potemkin and what's the one, La Jetée, and some of these others like that were just like film, you know, everybody who wants to be a film critic would have to have seen, right? And these are like really old films. And I remember going through these, and some of them were kind of agonizing for me, because I was like, what? Films are just for entertainment, and I just want to make fun films that like wow people or whatever. And I remember starting to learn that films had things that could teach me something. And I remember my roommate, and he said this to me Because and he wasn't not into film. In fact, he was the person who I watched The Matrix with for the first time, and we were trying to figure out what it meant. And you know, we were college kids, and we were relatively conservative. So like, this was so artistic in our world that we were like trying to figure out what is meant by The Matrix. And you know, there's always going to be one meaning because that's how we grew up thinking of meaning with messaging. And so his name was Phil. And he said to me, again in college, when I said, oh, well, you know, I'm just trying to see what this movie can teach me about life. And he goes, that's what I read the Bible for, Doug. And he didn't say it in like a sarcastic or even like judgmental way, but he was just kind of like, why would you go anywhere other than the Bible to like teach you how to live or about life or about yourself or about whatever? Like, God's already spoken to you for what you need to learn in life. I wish you had been also my roommate then too, so I could hear you react to him. Maybe not back then, because you'd probably been too young to really say anything smart. But what would you say there?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an underhanded critique of the Bible in a way, though, right? Because
okay,
what he's really saying is, if I want something fun or interesting or exciting, I go outside of the Bible. If I want to learn about, you know, dry things like values and what's important, then I'm going to look at the Bible for that. But I mean, like, but think about this. Prior to movies, why do ancient people tell stories? Why did they write stories? What's the Odyssey about? What's Beowulf about? It's about the values that these cultures have. It's partly that it's exciting and it's interesting, but it engages people in that culture in a way that it might not engage people today, because it touches on what's important to them, right? And it sort of clarifies those values in a way, even though it is an interesting story, a fun story to them. That's kind of what it's doing. That's why they told those stories. And so, I mean, and I think that's what you're getting in films. You're getting stories, sometimes based on a true story, sometimes not.
Yeah.
But what you're getting is it's another way to think about these things. I mean, Jesus told stories for that same reason.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like it's a one or the other thing. I don't think that, you know, you go to the Bible when you want to have a dry, you know, didactic lesson about morality, but if you want to do something fun, then you're going to go watch a movie.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the thing. Like with me growing up, it was kind of that. And I remember we went to see The Passion of the Christ. So again, imagine this like highly conservative church. We have, you know, Sunday morning service, Sunday night service, we have Wednesday prayer service. And, you know, and like obviously fewer and fewer people go to those services over, you know, from one to one that I just mentioned. And I remember the opening night of The Passion, which Mel Gibson's Passion, was on a Wednesday night, and we canceled Bible study to go see it, like, which blew my mind, right? And so the handful of people who go to these, we went to the movie. And I remember my brother and I were in line to get popcorn, and my dad thought this was sacrilege. Like, it was just such this weird thing. Like, you could see the tension in the way he's like, you're going to eat popcorn while your Lord is being crucified?
Yeah. Well, The Passion's an interesting example because people went to see it because it was a movie about the crucifixion that was playing in a movie theater. That was why people said we should go see it, right?
Yep.
But what made it actually a great movie was not that it represented a biblical story. That was not actually on its own enough to make it really interesting or worth seeing.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you remember most from The Passion, but me and other people that I know who saw it, including people who weren't Christians, what stuck out to them are the scenes with him and his mother. And Mel Gibson has a bit of an agenda here, because Mel Gibson's Catholic and he wants to sort of push this idea of that Mary is co-redemptrix and that she's suffering with Christ. But there's also just like, it's also like something that's not talked about in scripture, but it's also like obvious, right? Where it's like, she sees him stumble with the cross, and she thinks about him as a toddler, and he stumbles and falls, and she comes and helps him back up. And then so you have this sort of flashback and flash forward, and you sort of feel the pain of a mother. And it tells you, I think, something a little bit deeper about the fact that these aren't just, you know, texts on a page. These are about people. You know, these stories are they really happened. And you know, we may not, you know, Matthew or Mark or Luke or John may have not thought that it was really, you know, worthwhile to spare a lot of ink and parchment to discuss those personal relationships in that way.
Yeah.
But it's worth exploring. But it also gets us thinking about the world that we live in, and the violence and especially the state violence and the unjust state violence, and how you know, this is sort of a controversial example now because people have different thoughts about the, you know, autopsy and stuff like that. But in 2020, the thing that got us all thinking about police brutality was a man with a police officer's knee on his neck, and he's crying for his mother, who's dead. But that comes out of him, right? And so, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that when I think about the passion, that's what I think about. So there's some over-the-top violence and sort of throwing him over a bridge and dragging him back up with the chains and stuff. And some of that also is almost a little gratuitous. But or even just like, what's Judas going through? What's his experience? What leads him to say, I'm ending it, right?
Yeah.
That's not really discussed in scripture, but it's a very, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, what stuck out, what I remember at this point were a little bit of the gratuitousness. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I mean, if you think about sort of the more fundamentalist Baptist type, like the whole point of understanding the debt that we owe God was to know that the crucifixion was like the most horrific way to die. And your Lord did this for you. God did this for you. Okay. That's the messaging, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this didn't feel gratuitous to us.
Right.
And so this was just like, well, of course it was this bad. And of course we need to be exposed to this, because if we don't understand how ridiculously terrible and horrific, and I'll just use all the negative adjectives for the next 5 minutes.
Excruciating. This scene is
Excruciating. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, sorry.
I was trying to avoid that word. Thanks, Cody. how horrific it was. We really wouldn't truly, you know, it's because we don't know what Christ went through. But this film got us way closer and was the most accurate or whatever. I mean, nobody claimed it was the most accurate, but it, in terms of the emotional connection to what did your Lord do for you? Look how he suffered for you. That was the message that we heard. From an artistic perspective, I remember, I don't think anybody in my church noticed this, and not many people notice it, but early on, I don't remember where in the film it was. Again, I didn't see it since it came out. But I remember there being a scene where either Jesus or somebody is stepping on the head of a snake. And it reminds me of the, I guess, Genesis 3, where he says that, you know, you will bruise his heel, or you will, your head will, well, I forget the reference. But I'm remembering that this is a Garden of Eden scene, or Genesis 1-3 theme brought up in a scene in Jesus's life. And I just remember that being, and I remember like being a little proud of myself for noticing that, because that's not the kind of thing we get brownie points for noticing in films.
Well, so, but you know, it's interesting. We're kind of talking, when you talked about the suffering, I mean, that's a, you know, values clarifying thing that's happening there, right? Because what is it that we as Western Christians tend to think about when we think about Jesus's sacrifice for us? We think not that I may turn off some of the audience here now, but not that the wages of sin is death and that Jesus defeated death on our behalf, but the wages of sin is eternal torment. And so we have to emphasize not that Jesus died for us, but that Jesus was tortured for us. He doesn't die to save us from death. He's tortured to save us from torture. And so there's a message there. There's a reason why Gibson wants to really hit that home, because of how he thinks about what it means that Jesus suffered in our place. These are conversations that you can have if you know what to look for in these movies, if you pay attention and you think, I mean, and really what it is, you know, I remember being a kid and thinking, like, you know, reading books in grade school, and the teacher would talk about all the symbolism and stuff, and you'd think, she's probably making that up, right? You know, it's just a story. Because as a kid, that's how you approach
exactly how story. Yes.
Right. But when you're a decent author or writer or filmmaker, you make decisions. You say, I'm going to do this and not this. I'm going to have this character say that and not this.
Right.
And there's a reason for it, right? And so, you can read too much into it, or you can find something in there that the author is not really trying to say. That's of course can happen, but it's there for a reason. And so you can have these sort of conversations and think about it. Like, you know, I think evangelicals sometimes uncritically watch The Passion because they weren't thinking of it in terms of art. They thought of it in terms of, we're going to bring to life the Bible. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. In particular, what I said earlier about the excruciating, you know, experience of Christ. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I mean, Noah's one of those people. When the Noah movie came out, they said, well, it doesn't follow the Bible. So, well, it's three chapters in the Bible, guys. It's not going to follow the Bible. There's going to be more to it. we're not going to have 45-minute monologue about what the ark's made of, like we have in Genesis, you know, 7. So yeah, I mean, and you know, the stuff with the Nephilim, I'm like, well, that's not really accurate, but it's an interesting thing to think about, right? You know, is Noah struggling with, you know, this choice that the fact that God is destroying the world? Who is God? Is God vengeful?
Is God gracious?
And that's not in the text, but it comes out of the text.
I like the way Pete Enns put it, that basically the film Noah was Darren Aronofsky's midrash on Noah, on the story of Noah. Like that's like, yeah, okay, that tracks. Like that made it make sense for me. And I actually like the film. Okay. Well, we've been on for almost a full episode and we haven't even talked about the movies we said we were gonna talk about. So let's go through those a little bit. We don't have to be super quick, but also maybe just shorten the list. I mentioned earlier that there was a film that hit me as a kid as like just wow. And I had seen other movies before. And not only did this movie actually like just wow me as a 12-year-old, I guess. It was the reason I wanted to read. I started reading. And you'd think that it would be some artsier film than it really was, because the director who made this film actually made a really artsy film in the same year or within the next year, which was Schindler's List. And so in order to make Schindler's List, the production company, so the story goes, asked him to make something that was more like blockbustery. And so he made what I think is probably the best blockbuster film. Although I think Top Gun Maverick kind of gets up there, Jurassic Park. And it's, you know, any 12-year-old boy who's somewhat into like dinosaurs and like that kind of thing is going to be like wowed and scared and amazed at what was happening. And of course there's the artistic value of, or the creative value of realizing that this is kind of like, there's some breakthroughs here with the animatronics and some of the things that they used to create this. But it has always stuck with me that there is a drive in human beings to create things. I'm not talking about films, but the film itself, Jurassic Park, there's the drive in John Hammond to create something that will awe and inspire other humans. And of course, the premise of the story is that it all can't be controlled, right? And you have Ian Malcolm as the right character to kind of, you know, kind of explain all this, but nobody believes him and all that. And I don't know, maybe there's some like latent libertarian themes in that in some sense, in the way that like, hey, if you think you can control things, nature is complex. It's not simply complicated. And you can't control this. Life will find a way, as the, you know, the famous saying goes. And so I think a lot of those themes for me fill out sort of why, how do I put this? Sort of why I like watching movies that are very similar in this sense. Some of the other movies that I put down here were Minority Report, The Truman Show, Hunger Games, and Sphere. I don't know. Have you seen Sphere or read the book?
I haven't seen Sphere, actually. No.
Okay. So the book is way better. I mean, this is typical, right? The book is way better. But there are a lot of movies that were better than the books. But all of these movies have to do with hubris and the desire for one person to either create an experience out of like goodwill, like in Jurassic Park, right? And for that matter, even Minority Report and The Truman Show, they're trying to create something that will either protect or shield or do something for the society or even for themselves. And yet it just reveals that they can't control it. And yet this theme in a movie all the time is attractive to a lot of people. And I think there is this like human impulse to want to control things. And we're still willing to be reminded through film that we can't control everything, no matter how many systems, you know, you want to create to, you know, fail with fail safes and how well you trust your people and, you know, all that kind of thing. So, obviously that mixture of movies, Jurassic Park, Hunger Games, which is a trilogy, Sphere, Minority Report, The Truman Show, those are all very different genres, different ideas on a theme of how do I control, I call them kind of control freak movies. Some of them are, like I said, out of nefarious means, and some of them are just out of, you know, good natured means. So anyway, I kind of ran through mine. I can let you talk about a movie or so that you want to bring up.
Yeah, I'll mention a couple. Actually, riffing off what you said, about a year or so ago, you let me post a short video to the LCI YouTube page that was a short video about Thanos from the Marvel movies as like a central planner.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't really regret that decision, but of course, you know, the rest of the universe does. But it's that sort of thing, you know, all population control, that's a problem. I'm just going to just snap half of the people out of existence. It's a perfect kind of like central planner sort of solution. So let's see here. I'll mention a few. There's one called The Mission from 1986. This is, I think, one of the more recent movies that I'm going to mention because you mentioned how I got old movies.
Is that Lou Perez on the cover?
No, that is Robert De Niro.
Sorry. And do you know who Lou Perez is?
I don't know if I do know who Lou Perez is.
He was a guest on my show. He's a comedian, libertarian comedian. Okay. I met him at Freedom Fest, and then I met him in New York, and he's been on my show. He wrote a book called That's Not Funny Anymore. And it was about how, like, in somewhat way, why woke culture is like making it hard for comedians to be funny, because, like, not hard to be funny. You know what I mean? It's that whole phenomenon. Anyway, it just from this tiny little thumbnail I could see by you holding that up, it just looked like Lou Perez.
Well, so this is that being what it is. This is a great movie. So The Mission, it's got Robert De Niro, Jeremy Irons, Liam Neeson, kind of early for Liam Neeson. He's kind of young in it. And so what it is it takes place in, would it be South America? Yeah, South America, 18th century. And Jeremy Irons is this Jesuit missionary. And he set up this mission with this tribe called the Guarani. And he ends up taking under his wing Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro is a slave capturer. And so there's this whole kind of complicated thing where part of the territory is under Spanish control, part of it's under Portuguese. The Spanish have outlawed slavery. The Portuguese have it, but the Spanish are still trying to make money off of it. So they sort of have this arrangement with the Portuguese to kind of help them with the slave trade. And De Niro ends up murdering his brother because he's having an affair with his wife. And so he just is bearing all this sort of guilt. And they assign him to Jeremy Irons, this priest, to kind of help him kind of reform him or whatever. And so the first part of the movie, De Niro just doesn't say anything. He has this penance where he's carrying around this giant, like a bag full of like just heavy things. And so they're like climbing like cliffs and mountains and like doing, you know, trying to get to the tribe or whatever. And he's just carrying this huge, heavy load. And like, sometimes it'll like bring him, like, he'll lose control of it. And it'll like bring him down the side of the cliff, and he goes down and gets it and picks it up again. At one point, one of the priests gets angry and throws it off of him. Basically, it's like, you've done your penance, get over it, quit beating yourself up. He won't let it go. And so there's this great scene early on where they get to the Guarani, and these are the people he's been capturing and enslaving. And one of the men grabs a knife and comes at De Niro, and De Niro's like, sure, he's going to kill him. And he just sort of, he's like, just going to accept it. And the guy cuts the rope off the load and knocks it down the cliff. And De Niro starts crying. And then as he's crying, he starts laughing. And it's like, all the Guarani like kind of come around him, and they're laughing. And it's like it's the people whom he's harmed are now forgiving him, and the load can come off. And such a great scene. And then De Niro now is like a huge advocate for the tribe. And there's this whole big thing where the church is supposed to offer the protection, but they don't want to upset the Spanish and the Portuguese because, you know, now the Protestant thing's happening and they don't want to lose control, you know, or influence in these countries. And so to save the church, they choose to not intervene and protect the Guarani. They're going to let the Spanish and Portuguese do what they want with them. And Irons sort of leads a faction of the Guarani who are going to resist nonviolently. And De Niro leads a faction that's actually going to use violence to try to repel them. And I won't spoil the end, but the musical score is by Ennio Morricone, who some people might know as the guy who did a lot of spaghetti Western musicals, scores. So like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and the kind of whole Man with No Name trilogy. And it's just such a great score. It's a beautiful, perfect score.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
So can I pick one of your off your list?
Sure.
I want you to talk about, what was it here? Hold on. Let's do Dark Knight trilogy.
Okay. So I've got that one.
Because I've seen that it was a while. But by the way, hold up The Mission again. The irony that I didn't point out that you're holding up a VHS tape is yeah, like, that's great. That's probably worth $1 million right there. Because it's, well, you know.
The thing, Doug, is there's very few movies that have been made that are very good that are not available on VHS. and they're usually pretty cheap to
anymore.
Get all. Yeah, they're usually pretty cheap to get all. Yeah, there's not that many good movies that they made.
Believe it or not, I have a VHS player in my house.
Not many people do. If you see any cheap ones, let me know. Well, I guess you're not very close to me. I'm trying to collect them so that way I can make sure I can always watch my
tape. So what you want to do, here's how you do it. You find one of those dual players where it's like DVD and VHS player. Yeah, I bought this one like 15 years ago. So that makes sense. The Dark Knight.
I've literally had dreams that I found VHS players at VCRs at like Walmart, like new in the box. And I was just so excited in the dream, and I was just scooping them up and grabbing them. And then I woke up and realized that it was just a dream. Anyway, so Dark Knight Trilogy, I actually have that one on DVD. They didn't release these on VHS for some reason.
Ooh, you're really, that's really cool.
And so I actually think this is a great example of where you can miss something that's actually really important. And because it was such a pop culture phenomenon, you could have conversations with your friends about it and sort of say, well, isn't this interesting? How about this connection here?
Yeah. So, okay.
Batman Begins has a little bit of that. That's the first one. This kind of revenge idea. And there's like the non-aggression principle sort of comes up in a way, you know, Batman is not going to, you know, initiate violence and he's not going to kill anybody. But there's this great line where the bad guy, he says, well, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. Right. And that's a really interesting distinction to make because it's a very non-aggression principle kind of thing to say.
Yeah.
But obviously as Christians, like, well, we probably want to do a little better than that. So there's some stuff to think about there. The Dark Knight is, I think, that the second one is where I think it really gets really interesting for Christians and libertarians, especially Christians. So, you know, the libertarians, I thought about doing an article about this, Joker's speech about planned violence versus unplanned violence. Mm-hmm. Where he says, you know, if you announce that 1,000, you know, Iraqis or whatever have been bombed, people go, okay. But if you're like, oh, you know, we're going to kill a goat tomorrow. It's like, what do you mean you're going to kill a goat tomorrow? And so there's this like thing of like when it's planned, when it's part of the plan, when the state's behind it, that's one thing. But like this kind of violence as that's unexpected or that's chaotic, you know, Joker's not a bad guy because he's killing people because the government does that. He's a bad guy because he's killing people and it's not sanctioned in an unofficial capacity. There's a really interesting, I think, thing to have a discussion there about for libertarians. For Christians, the substitutionary atonement metaphor. Did you know that there was a substitutionary atonement metaphor in the Dark Knight?
It's been a while since I saw them pretty much when they came out on Blu-ray that time, I guess. Okay. I don't remember. So you just have to spell it out. Besides, you're going to have to do that for our audience anyway.
That's fine.
So tell me.
Three major characters that are important here: Batman, Joker, and Harvey Dent, who becomes Two-Face. Harvey Dent is Adam. Joker is Satan. Batman is Jesus. And so here's how it works. You've got Joker. He's a Satan figure. He wants to watch the world burn. There's this line he says, everything burns. He's actually, and his whole goal is to sort of demonstrate that everybody is really bad. And he's going to basically try to corrupt people to twist them and bring out the worst part of who they are. And so Harvey Dent character, he's the DA. He's sort of seen as like this kind of very moral, kind of upright, righteous figure. And so Joker really focuses in on him because if he can corrupt him, then that has sort of a moral effect on Gotham, right? If the best of them can be corrupted, then they all sort of, then basically all of Gotham goes down, right? And so here, Dent is a, what's the term the reformed like to use? Where you have sort of one person who stands in for everybody else.
Scapegoat?
No, not the scapegoat. Federal headship kind of thing, right?
Oh, okay.
Right. So he sort of represents the people, right?
Okay.
And so if Joker can corrupt him, and there's going to be some spoilers here. So, and he does, and he becomes Two-Face. And there's this whole thing where part of him is like sort of like evil and part of him is good. And it's almost like a matter of chance, which, you know, he has this coin that he flips and so he's us. He's good, but he's also bad. He's been corrupted now. So there's a part of him that's good. There's a part of him that's bad. And the bad side ultimately kind of wins out in the film. And because Batman knows the risk of what's going to happen if people understand that Dent's been corrupt, that actually destroys Gotham too, morally. He is willing to take accountability for Harvey Dent's crimes. So that way Harvey Dent dies looking like a hero who's never corrupted. He's still good. But Batman is the bad guy because there's a line Commissioner Gordon says, you know, we'll hunt him because he can take it.
Okay. All right.
Right. So it's pretty interesting here, right? So in
well, it seems like that's like an overt or a very obvious analogy or metaphor, but also not heavy-handed.
Yeah, it's something you could miss if you're not looking for it, but it's 100% there, and it's unfortunately not a happy ending for Calvinists because Joker is disappointed to learn that people aren't totally depraved. There is actually some good in people. But aside,
we don't go. But Cody, as my roommate Phil said, we don't go to the Bible. We go to the Bible for our theology, not a Zack Snyder film.
Right, right. Well, and I don't mind it because I'm an Anabaptist, but I'm just living Calvinist, though, that you might quibble with that. And so then the third movie in the series, The Dark Knight Rises, that I think we get a little bit more into some of the libertarian stuff again, where Bane he's going to do sort of the same thing. He's trying to sort of corrupt Gotham. He wants it to be destroyed. And so he uses identity politics. He uses populist vengeance against the wealthy. And so it's kind of happening around the time of the kind of what do they call that? The Wall Street Occupy Wall Street movement.
Yeah.
And the banks are getting kind of destroyed. The money's inflated or whatever. And so somebody's like, you know, hey, they're taking all our money. They're destroying the banks. And some kind of poor person says, well, it's not my money. And then, you know, I don't care if rich people are losing their money. And then he said, you don't understand. It affects all of us. Your money's not going to be worth anything if all of our currency is devalued. Right. And so so Bane sort of uses that kind of hatred of the rich to basically destroy everybody, to destroy all of Gotham. So there's a really interesting kind of message there about populism, I think. I'll mention one more. It's not in the series, but it comes a little bit later, the Batman versus Superman. Did you see that movie?
No, I didn't, no.
A lot of people didn't like it, and there's one scene in particular that they didn't like. It's at the very end of the movie. So basically, Batman doesn't trust Superman. Lex Luthor doesn't trust Superman. They don't trust him because he is like a godlike figure. And it basically goes back to the fact they don't trust God. They don't think that God is good. And so they sort of filter that through their perception of Superman. And Batman's like, gets this like sort of, you know, kryptonite armor, and he's going to basically kill Superman because Superman can't be trusted. He's got all this power. And there's a scene where Superman mentioned, we're talking about calling out for the mother. He calls out in reference to his mother, Martha, and that's also Batman's mom. He has, her name is another woman, but her name is
same
also
name
Martha. Right. And so that, for whatever reason, something clicks in Batman's head and he stops in his tracks and he realizes he's not just this kind of weird superpowered alien. He's one of us. He's a human too. He loves and he experiences pain. He's in it with us. He's not this sort of foreign thing that sort of this powerful thing that hates us. Now, if you've ever read, you know, Jürgen Moltmann or some of these, you know, these great theologians who say, you know, why is it that Jesus is so significant for this question of the problem of evil? Well, because unlike Allah or unlike maybe a Jewish conception of God, Jesus becomes one of us. And that's why we know he's on our side. And that's why we know when suffering takes place, we're not alone. And he's not doing it because he hates us or he doesn't care about us, because he got in there with us. And I mean, it's a beautiful, I mean, theodicy, really. A discussion of the justification of God, and despite the fact that there's evil in the world. So anyway, some people didn't like, they thought that it was a little ham-fisted to do the Martha thing, but they didn't really they also didn't get what it was happening. And I think there's writers for the Dark Knight trilogy that were shared with Batman versus Superman. So I think that there's very intentional Christological things happening in those movies.
Wow.
We're right about an hour. So we've got more on the list. Do you want to mention any more before we wrap up?
I think we're good. I think the films that you mentioned are really good. I mean, I threw out mine a little bit just as like, hey, here's what interests me. And also here is like kind of some of the kinds of movies that attract me to talk about, or at the very least just enjoy. So I often, I will say, like, I have a friend who like really likes the Lord of the Rings movies. And I always think, how could you not be a libertarian, with the whole one ring of power theme? And like, how could you be, you know, a Democrat, or how could you be somebody who really wants the state to do things? Like, you love Lord of the Rings. Didn't you get the message?
Right.
Anyway, I don't know why I said all that, but, no, I think we can wrap up here. This would be a good place to wrap up. And, if there are, for those of you listening, you can email Cody and me, on libertarianchristians.com. You can go there and fill out the contact form. We would love to know what movies, do you think would be great films for libertarians to watch, ones that have maybe not overtly libertarian themes, but themes that will engender discussion, that will help us talk more about libertarian themes. So we also invite you to do that.
I love listening to stuff like this because it gives me ideas for things I've never seen before, but I think I would like. So if there's a movie that was mentioned here that you hadn't seen, but then you watched it because we talked about it, let us know what you thought about it.
Oh, that's even, yes, that's also good. Do that as well. So libertarianchristians.com/contact. You can just pick the drop down, send us a message, be happy to converse with you about that. Well, at this point, we will wrap it up. Thanks, Cody, for your time and for your prep on coming up with these movies for us to talk about, and for having some really thoughtful things to say. Appreciate it.
There's a lot on my list we didn't talk about, man, but maybe some other time. I'm looking at my list thinking we didn't talk about Mr. Majestic. We didn't talk about Rocky IV. We didn't talk about Duck Soup.
I tried to get my daughter and wife to watch Duck Soup with me, and then they were like, no, because it's 1933. And I was like, well, what about 12 Angry Men? And they're like, no. And we ended up watching Maze Runner, which I didn't like.
My wife loves 12 Angry Men. I think that's a great one too.
It is, it is a good one.
Duck Soup is funny. It's early March.
I think the trailer was a little bit like not good as a trailer, so that might have kind of thrown it off.
It's so funny. It's really anarchic. It's, I mean, super critical of kind of the war state and just the pettiness. I mean, Duck Soup.
All right. So everybody go watch Duck Soup. And if you beat me to it, that's fine. I'll probably watch it soon though. All right, Cody, we're going to end it here.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.